Hello, everyone. This is episode one of a two-part series on the new patient-driven payment system that's going to dictate payments for skilled nursing facility SNFs starting October 1st, 2019. This episode, we're going to focus on the nuts and bolts of the program. And in the next episode, we'll get into more of the day-to-day operational issues and tension points associated with implementing a brand new payment program. I want to start off by thanking our sponsor. This AHLA podcast is sponsored by the Polaris Group, a national long-term care consulting firm specializing in Medicare compliance, clinical operation, and financial consulting. The group performs mock surveys, MDS accuracy audits, PDPM training, independent review organization, and more. So thank you to them. My name is Dan Hedick. I'm a partner in King & Spalding's healthcare practice group. I'm resident in Washington, D.C. I focused my career on Medicare reimbursement issues of all types for all providers, especially hospitals and healthcare systems. I'm very pleased. I'll be moderating these episodes, and I'm very happy to be joined by my two co-presenters, Judy Kulis and Mike Cheek. Judy, do you want to introduce yourself?
Yes, good morning or hello everyone. I'm Judy Kulis, the Chief Nursing Executive for Lantis Enterprises, and we're an organization that has 22 skilled nursing facilities, 11 assisted living, and a number of other healthcare organizations in the continuum. And I'm pleased to speak with you today on this call, as I was able to serve on the technical expert panel for the RCF1 program that it was the precursor to the PDPM. So looking forward to sharing with you today.
And I'm Mike Cheek. I'm the Senior Vice President for Reimbursement Policy and Business Strategy with the American Healthcare Association. We represent about 13,000 SNFs across the country. I had the privilege of working with Judy over the past couple of years on the development of what's now called the patient-driven payment model, the new PPS for skilled nursing facilities. And it's spent the past year traveling to pretty much every state in the country, training on PDPM operational issues and helping members understand how to prepare for the transition from RUGs to PDPM.
Great, thank you both. Well, let's get started. Judy, maybe I'll kick it off with you. I think it would be helpful. Could you give us kind of a nutshell overview of some of the biggest changes between the new patient-driven payment model, PDPM, and the prior RUG 4 system? In other words, why isn't this simply RUG 5?
Yeah, well, it's a really different system as those that are looking at it and preparing their facilities for implementation on October 1, 2019. The RUG system, as many are experienced with, has 66 RUGs that is based on the volume of care that's provided primarily. And as we've seen, the highest number of RUGs that are billed to Medicare in the RUGs 4 system tends to be the high therapy, very high, ultra high. And so we're dealing with lots of therapy minutes that are driving the payment in many of the RUGs that are billed. There's also the opportunity to build nursing RUGs and other RUGs in the system, but primarily we end up focusing on the volume of therapy rather than what the PDPM system does is it changes to focus on the patient characteristics. And we'll get into more of the components in just a few minutes, but really the characteristics of the patient, it's much more granular of a system, much more complex with many more components driving the payment. And so rather than having one fixed daily rate, it's a combination of six multiple different rates that go into that daily per diem. Both systems are per diem. However, how we arrive at that payment is much more complex in the PDPM system. And the nice thing about it is that it is really going to create a unique payment for each patient based on their needs and their like we said, the characteristics and the diagnosis and the services that they're receiving. The other thing that has happened in the PDPM is there's a change in how HIV and AIDS payments are made. They've woven it into the daily per diem rate it's still going to be captured on the claim with the B20 code. However, it's not a carve out like it was in the RUG system. It's going to be just woven into the system. So generally speaking, the PDPM, as I've said, is much more granular, more complex in looking at all of the needs, the nursing needs, the therapy needs, the functional needs of the resident, the diagnosis, the services that are being provided, that goes into that daily rate. And Mike, I don't know if you want to add anything about what you see, the difference between RUGs and PDPM.
So I think the two things that I would add, you know, Judy, you alluded to it in your comments, is that CMS has really emphasized their expectation that care plans will be highly individualized based on the more flexible nature of the case of the components and related case mix groups, and that their expectation is that plans be individualized, holistic, and highly heterogeneous within a building. So the cookie cutter approach to assigning a certain number of therapy minutes and therefore a single RUG assignment is the antithesis of what they expect to see under this new payment system. They also will link out that holistic individualized focus on that type of care plan to outcomes. And they have a very specific list of QRPs, quality reporting program measures under the Impact Act, that they already have benchmarked at the individual SNF level that they will be using to assess provider performance going forward.
Mike, with all of these significant changes, I mean, we said already that the new payment system scheduled to take effect on October 1st. Is CMS going to have a transition period to allow SNFs to you know, transition from RUGS 4 to PDPM?
They will not. There is no transition period. Beginning on October 1, the system will convert from the Resource Utilization Group, or RUGS, to PDPM, the patient-driven payment model. We've been encouraging our members to treat all September admissions as if they were PDPM admissions, both to practice that admission process, because there's a great deal of intensity that has to go into collecting the adequate clinical information for case mix group assignment. Also, CMS's logic here was that running two payment systems would be highly problematic for providers as well as CMS. Having some sort of blended rate system between RUGs and PDPM is simply not possible. As Judy pointed out, these two payment systems are fundamentally different, so the notion of a blended approach is not feasible.
Great. Judy, you alluded to in your overview kind of the six components of payments. Can you describe those in a little more detail for us?
Sure. There are going to be, as I said, six components. One is the PT case mix group. The second component is the OT, or occupational therapy case mix group. There's a separate speech language pathology group. There's a separate nursing case mix group, and a non-therapy ancillary case mix group. And all of those five groups are variable. They have different payments based on case mix index, and I'll explain those briefly in just a minute. But the sixth component that goes into making up the daily rate is a non-case mix component, which isn't variable. It's a fixed set payment that will be added to each of the daily payment rates. So looking at the PTOT components, both of them are designed the same. The first thing that will happen is the facilities will be selecting the primary reason for the Medicare A stay. And that reason, that diagnosis, should be mapped to one of a few components that's going to drive the 16 case mix index groups for the PTOT component. Major joint replacement or spinal surgery is one group, other orthopedic, medical management, and then a non-orthopedic surgery and acute neurological component. So these components, primarily driven by that single diagnosis, will determine the PTOT functional group or case mix index. The other thing that will be filtered into it is what I mentioned, the functional index. There are 10 functional items that are coming off of the MDS section GG. So it's things like eating, oral hygiene, toileting, a number of mobility items, and how the resident can transfer and walk, and their bed mobility, as I said. So these 10 items will be calculated together for a final score that will drive the case mix index for the 16 groups for the PTOT component. Now, they are calculated separately with different case mix index and different payments. And as you look closer at the components, it's helpful to see that some of the diagnosis, like major joint replacement and so on, will be having a higher payment in the PT areas. And then some of the diagnosis, like medical management, will have the OT will be a higher payment than PT. So it's really filtered based on the diagnosis and based on the anticipated services for PT and OT that will be given. For speech language pathology, it's there's 12 case mix index. And with this, there's the opportunity to have a variable payment based on whether the patient has acute neurological conditions, related comorbidities, things like aphasia, CVA, stroke, hemiplegia, and there's a list of items that would go into the comorbidities. And if the resident or patient has those conditions, the case mix index will be a little higher. Also contributing to the speech language pathology is cognitive impairment. And so I think having a resident or patient that has some level of cognitive impairment is going to increase the payment for the speech language component. The other, call it an end split, that's going to cause a variable payment in the speech language component is swallowing disorder and the mechanically altered diet. And so those are key items that if the patient has a swallowing disorder where they're choking or coughing or have a problem with swallowing, they'll get a higher payment as well as mechanically altered diet. So the speech language pathology is variable based on, again, you can see the patient characteristics that contribute to the needs of the patient. The nursing component does match closely to the RUGS 4 group. There's some familiarity that we have with that. It's a condensed from the RUGS 4 system, but it still includes extensive services, special care high, special care low, clinically complex, and behavior, symptoms, and cognition, and the reduced physical functioning. The other characteristics that the patient would have that contributes to the nursing payment is 7 of the Section GG 8 functional scores. So eating again, toilet hygiene, mobility related to bed mobility, and the transfers. And these match closely to the RUGS 4 system in the sense that they are the late loss ADLs, but they're using the new Section GG item of the MDS rather than the RUGS system that uses the Section G item. For the nursing components, the other contributing factors to the payment is whether the resident has depression scoring or not depressed, as well as restorative nursing plays a part in certain of the categories in the nursing component. So that's the nursing component. And then the non-therapy ancillaries, which we're going to dig into a little bit more, but there's 50 items that each will contribute to a non-therapy ancillary score. And of those 50 items, one of them, which is the HIV AIDS, would be noted on the claim, but the rest would be noted on the MDS. And of those, half of them would be categorized in the I-8000 category of Section I of the MDS. And the reason why I mention that is that the facility teams, the nurses that are coding ICD-10, will have to select a proper ICD-10 code to capture those non-therapy ancillary items on the MDS. The rest are checked as a Section I of the MDS. And each of these items have different levels of scoring. And the case mix index for the non-therapy ancillary would be based on the scoring that the resident patient receives from the characteristics that they match in the listing of the non-therapy ancillary items. So I've reviewed just briefly PT, OT, speech, nursing, non-therapy ancillaries, and hopefully this has been a quick overview of the components and some highlights of how the system is deriving the payment.
Thank you, Judy. Yeah, there's certainly a lot there. And I think summarizing that, right, each of those six components have a base rate, and then there's the kind of the complicated rules that you were going through of how that base rate is adjusted based on a resident's actual condition or needs. And that's the case mix adjustment. Well, at least five of the six are adjusted by the case mix index. And that last one is basically room and board, right? Is that correct?
Mm-hmm. Yes, correct. Yep.
Mike, as Judy said, I mean, previously the non-therapy ancillaries, which encompass things like drugs, importantly, and devices and things of that nature, was bundled into the nursing component. Now CMS has separated it out into its own component that can be separately adjusted based on that list of 50 conditions. Could you explain to us a little bit more the significance of that? I know long-term care pharmacies are very interested in that change that I think a lot of people thought was a long time coming.
Sure. So it's under the resource utilization group system or RUGS, non-therapy ancillaries were combined with the nursing component, so that it was a single component. CMS assumed that roughly 45%, based on their research of the payments for the nursing and non-therapy ancillary component under RUGS, 45% were comprised of non-therapy ancillary expenses, medications, durable medical equipment, et cetera, that were ordered for a specific patient. They used that percentage roughly risk-adjusted to arrive at a separate non-therapy ancillary component. Under the initial iteration of the payment system that we now know as the patient-driven payment model, previously RCS-1, CMS condensed a much more extensive list of conditions and extensive services down to the 50 that Judy noted. Each of these is intended to capture specific high prevalence conditions and extensive services based on CMS's analysis of MSDRGs and utilization of certain extensive services that they distill down to this 50. Each of the 50 items has a certain number of points assigned to them. HIV/AIDS being having the most points with 8. So when classifying a patient into the non-therapy ancillary component, an MDS coordinator in the clinical team or interdisciplinary team would go through, identifies all the conditions and extensive services that a patient might have or need, then sums those points to arrive at a total. The total number of points is what's used to assign a patient to a case mix group and the related case mix index. What's particularly important about the non-therapy ancillary to understand relates to the variable per diem schedule that's associated with it. CMS front-loaded the payments for non-therapy ancillaries, so whatever the rate is associated with the case mix group is multiplied by 3 for the first 3 days of a stay. Beginning on day 4, the payments drop by 2/3. You have the ability over the course of the stay, of course, to adjust the case mix group for non-therapy ancillary, for the non-therapy ancillary component, but the variable per diem schedule does not return to day 1. So missing a certain number of points and not appropriately categorizing someone into the most appropriate case mix group so that you start at your starting point for the variable per diem schedule is not at the appropriate point, then it could cause some notable problems for you later in the stay in terms of covering costs of care.
And Mike, this is a big change. The variable, this concept of a variable per diem rate, where you're not, a SNF is not simply getting the same payment for each component from day one through day 100, but the fact that it varies based on the length of stay, that's pretty significant, isn't it?
It is. And it's based on research that CMS conducted where their work with their contractor Acumen indicated that the bulk of costs for non-therapy ancillaries were incurred during the first 3 days when medications and equipment are ordered for a specific patient, and that the costs for physical therapy and occupational therapy again are higher during the first portion of the stay, due to set up an assessment costs associated with physical therapy and occupational therapy. Those are the other two components that taper over the course of the stay. A physical therapy and occupational therapy begin to taper on day 21, and then decrease every 7 days by 2% after that. I think that in terms of overall revenue for a given provider and being sure that you have adequate revenue to care for all of your patients is being able to, again, code accurately, particularly for the non-therapy ancillary component, because the consolidated billing rules and statutory language remain the same. So being able to capture as much of those medication expenses using the NTA component is critical. And then over time, once the non-therapy ancillary component decreases on day 4 and PT/OT decrease every 7 days beginning on day 21, the proportion of overall per diem payment for a patient becomes increasingly dependent on the nursing component over the course of longer stays. So in terms of the variable per diem schedule, the real crux here is getting non-therapy ancillary correct and also making sure that your nursing component is correctly assigned as well.
Great. Judy, do you have any thoughts on the variable per diem rate?
As Mike said, the front-loaded aspect of it does help with the fact that many of the medications you might order the supply for potentially the whole month, say a 30-day supply, is something that the patient needs. So that's the concept behind this front-loaded. I think some people have reacted that they're concerned about the decrease in payment to the non-therapy ancillary on day 4. But again, the front-loaded system is designed to allow facilities to financially fund that resident's ancillary needs, the medications, treatments for wounds, and other supplies up front. And hopefully that will allow them then to care for the patient for the remaining part of the stay as that small payment comes in on day 4, but it sustains them through the stay. But as Mike said, it's going to be really careful or really important for facilities to, one, capture the non-therapy ancillaries that will contribute to a higher score effectively and accurately, as well as manage the types of medications and supplies they order to meet their patient's need, but to do it with, as where possible, generic drugs and or appropriate evidence-based treatment supplies that are also efficient for finances as well. So just managing to meet the residents' needs within the scope that can be controlled with the expenses that are incurred during the resident stay.
Great. So Judy, what are some other key clinical and financial drivers under the PDPM?
Oh, that's a great question. One way I want to frame the answer to this idea of looking at the financial and clinical outcomes for a Medicare patient, this is Medicare A, is what isn't changing. And what isn't changing is the rules around covering a patient for Medicare A. And Chapter 8 of the Medicare Benefit Policy Manual outlines the requirements for the patient to have daily skilled need of therapy, which is 5 days a week, for at least 15 minutes of therapy. The nursing is 7 days a week, and there's a list of clear, finite activities that qualify to bill Medicare for a Medicare A patient. And I mention that to say that that hasn't changed. So when we are looking at caring for a patient in the Medicare A system, the rules and the coverage criteria for doing that are the same in this new system as they are in RUGs. However, the payment is going to be different as we've outlined here. So some of the key financial drivers in the system are going to be the items that are going to pay in the higher amount are the major joint replacement, anticipating that the needs of the patient would be the therapy for recovery post-surgery. Other orthopedic, those higher RUGs on the PTOT category, the higher nursing items that are scalable, things like a new G-tube, trach vents that are new. There's other items in nursing that financially will pay more that is also coverable under Medicare A. And so it's important to look at that. Some of the, when you look at the clinical needs of a patient in looking at PT and OT, it's interesting to note that as the system determines a score for the functional needs of the patient that will increase the case mix index in a PT-OT component, the patient that has the highest level of dependency and or the highest level of independence is going to actually score higher than a patient that has some ability to provide for their own eating, oral hygiene, you know, the mobility items of bed mobility and transfers and walking. The case mix index system grants basically in some categories higher payment to those that are in the middle that aren't totally dependent or totally independent. And I mention that to say that those are the patients that have some ability for improvement, and yet they're not independent, so they don't need PT or OT. And so it's clear that the clinical needs of a patient with some ability for improvement in their functional status, those are the patients that will have a higher payment in order to provide the heavier level of therapy to meet their needs, which is very logical, makes sense in how the system is working. Conversely, for the nursing components, those residents with the higher level of dependencies will end up having a higher payment, regardless of the case mix group that they're in. Those that are in special care high, special care low, the clinically complex, and even the higher levels of extensive services, those with the greater dependencies are going to also result in a higher payment to meet those patients' needs. So that's a component of that. And then when you look at the non-therapy ancillaries, the system will provide additional funding for those that have some of the high clinical needs, such as IV feeding, vent care, respiratory care, G-tube. Those are the kind of items that also will result in a higher payment. So I've highlighted some of the clinical areas, whether it's a higher functional level or a higher diagnosis with some of the complex nursing, as well as the surgical outcomes that result in higher therapies that drive that financial payment. But we can see that, again, as long as those diagnoses and the needs of those patients match the requirements under the Medicare A benefit, it can be a win-win for those patients that meet the Medicare A criteria that we have, that have the high complex needs, the need for high therapy, and that will drive the system. But again, because it's granular, we want to be looking at each of the different components and make sure that we're capturing the matching items that are in place for that particular patient, so we don't miss out on some area payment that we are needing to provide care for.
I think something I'd like to add to that is, you know, just the sheer number of NDS items that now drive payment. There are roughly 20 under RUGs that resulted in assignment to a RUGs case mix group. There are about 188 NDS items that are associated with payment now under PDPM. So being able to retool your admission process to complete with CMS now calls the initial Medicare assessment under the final rule for this year is going to require some real reorganization of your admissions team and how they communicate with hospitals and other clinicians in order to collect that information, code appropriately, and arrive at the most accurate case mix group feasible.
So, Mike, we heard at the outset that, you know, while RUGS 4 was driven heavily by the number of therapy minutes provided to a SNF resident, that under PDPM, that's going to shift more to resident conditions and needs. What role, if any, will therapy minutes continue to play under PDPM?
So, I was really glad that Judy led off with her description of the SNF level of care, because I think that using that as a framework for this discussion point, as well as the overall discussion around PDPM, is an important one. Because I think over time with RUGS, as the system has evolved, particularly the way that it pays, with such a heavy emphasis on therapy, that we've not paid as much attention to what residents require in regard to skilled nursing, skilled therapy, as well as restorative care, and how often that's required. So I think that that's an important context to start with this, that that it's intended to be an array of services. When you know, drilling down a bit on therapy and its role, CMS has said that considering the end of the September 30th, looking towards October 1, if a patient needed a 720 minutes of therapy on September 30th, they would expect to see the same number of minutes delivered on October 1. If that's what the patient needs and the medical documentation supports it, in terms of transition, what a patient needs is what a patient needs. The actual number of minutes don't play into this at all for purposes of payment. They only relate to the number of minutes that are associated with particular modalities of delivery of therapy, individual and then group and concurrent. CMS will be assessing the number of minutes for group and concurrent as 25%. For group and concurrent. They'll be collecting that on the discharge MDS. They have their own method for assessing that total for a building, but if a SNF chooses to track that and report that themselves, they have that option. But the only approach that CMS is taking to assessing therapy as opposed to minutes is tracking for 25%. And tracking for outcomes associated with the delivery of therapy for patients.
Judy, one issue that we haven't talked about too much yet is the resident assessments, the mandatory assessments of resident functioning, which under RUG 4, there were multiple mandatory assessments periodically every certain number of days. Under PDPM, CMS has reduced that and given kind of an optional assessment if a patient's condition has changed significantly. Could you explain to us just a little bit more about that?
Sure. I think many MDS nurses around the country are going to be celebrating on October 1 that the volume of assessments, the 14, 30, 60, 90 day, and we have end of therapy, start of therapy, change of therapy assessments, so those are all going away. And you can see, since the system is no longer being driven by the volume of care provided, which these assessments done so frequently measured and kept the payment accurate based on the volume of care. We're moving to a characteristics-based system that will establish the resident's characteristics at the beginning of the stay, and there will be that 5-day start of Medicare assessment that very well could pay for the entire Medicare A stay through the end. And with that being the case, we might see that there'll be the start of Medicare and the end of Medicare assessment, and that may be it. Now, because of the fact that sometimes the course of treatment has unexpected, you know, twists and turns, there is the option called the IPA, the Interim Payment Assessment, and that is an assessment that is strictly optional. And CMS has indicated that they are not expecting that there will be very many IPAs done throughout a Medicare A stay, primarily because as the resident continues to improve throughout the stay, that we wouldn't probably do a payment adjustment. However, there are conditions or situations where a resident could decline. They could have a change in their care status, in which case the burden of care might increase such that having an increased payment through doing an IPA might be warranted, and again, it's optional. The thing that is important to consider with this is just the fact of monitoring it. It's optional, and to do it in a discretionary way. As the resident improves, or let's just say, for example, that the payment for therapy might go up if a change occurs, that as they improve, as their ADLs improve, maybe the payment would go up if you did an IPA. However, as the resident improves, their nursing component would go down, the payment would go down. So the caution for any facility in doing an IPA is to always calculate the full payment with all 5 of the components, and then, of course, including the fixed component, the 6th one, before making a determination, because we could see that when we recalculate the potential change, it might go down, but another item might go up. And so we need to look at the net effect of the change and then optionally choose to do it if it's warranted to, in this case, to change the payment such that it meets the needs of the care that you're providing to that patient throughout their stay.
Mike, my understanding is that, I'm sorry, did you have something to add on that, Mike?
Yeah, I was going to say, building on what Judy said, CMS specifically states in the final FY19 rule that they assume stable patient characteristics, and that they would expect interim payment assessments to be infrequent, as Judy said. I think that the language in the final rule for FY20 is also really worth reading quite carefully, because relative to what she just described, they go to some length to discuss SNF's responsibility under current regulation and law to maintain a care plan that is appropriate for patients' changing needs over time. So while they say under PDPM, the assumption is that a stable patient characteristics based on their predictive modeling, the expectation that the IPAs will be infrequent, they also reinforce a SNF's responsibility to monitor for changes in a patient's care needs and to update the care plan as needed.
Thank you, Mike. I was going to ask Mike about the net effect on reimbursement. My understanding is that CMS has said that they intend the transition to be budget neutral, and they'll be applying a budget neutrality adjustment to the system overall. But does that mean that individual SNFs won't see a change in payments based on their current resident mix?
So CMS conducted a provider-specific simulation for what would have been paid in FY17 for the patient-driven payment model based on the patient mix from that year, and looked at what PDPM payments would look like. They assumed some, they made some assumptions around the patient population and from there projected increases and decreases in payment. What's important to note relevant related to that is that those assumptions were based on data from existing MDS and clinical information that they extrapolated from hospitals. So how PDPM actually plays out when we begin to code using the new MDS and the new RAI manual guidance associated with the new MDS, those numbers may be directionally correct in some instances, and others they may be not. They may not, because the data points did not exist when CMS conducted the simulation that it did. In terms of the overall payment system transition from RUGs to PDPM, CMS included a budget neutrality adjustment factor for transitioning for RUGs to PDPM. They trended forward and assessed what the expenditure should look like in the transition year moving from RUGs to PDPM. They used a figure that Acumen arrived at, and it's this description is located in the technical report. The multiplier is 1.46, that they multiplied all of the case mix indices for all case mix groups by to ensure that the dollar amounts would result in an overall aggregate budget neutral transition from one payment system to another. Whether that actually works out the way they anticipated is yet to be seen.
Mike, what about the effect on individual SNFs? Can they expect their payments to remain substantially similar to what they were on the RUGs 4, or is that going to vary?
As I mentioned, because CMS used the existing MDS information under RUGs and hospital information to assess what PDPM simulated payments would look like under provider-specific payment file that's available at their website. That's their best guess. Our members have been conducting their own assessments of what they think this will look like. But again, because the data points don't exist, they're imputing data from manually in some instances. They're using proxy information as CMS did. So we think that most of the of our members have arrived at directionally correct increases and decreases in overall revenue, but I think that magnitude and the accuracy of it all we will not know really until we get to November or perhaps December once we have a couple of cycles of claim submission.
Great. Well, as we wrap this up, Judy. As I mentioned, we're going to have the next episode of this podcast series is going to be dedicated to day-to-day operational issues and tension points associated with the new payment system, and we've hinted at them. But maybe you could bring us home by giving us a preview of what you think are some of the biggest implementation challenges that SNFs are going to face in implementing the new payment system.
Sure. I think right out the gate, one of the challenges that are continually facing the facilities is to capture the proper ICD-10 diagnosis coding for the primary reason, and that is to put the patient into the proper group right out the gate, and capturing the diagnosis is for ICD-10. Now, the system's been in effect for quite some time, but the specificity or the detail that's needed to get to a code that doesn't give you a rejected code, which in the system is a return to provider code, that's one of the challenges that nurses are facing, is to obtain the information on the pre-admission screening form as the patient transfers in and there's transfer information, to have enough information in the documentation from the doctor to select the proper code that is specific enough. So the tension and the collaboration between the nursing teams and the provider teams is going to be critical moving into PDPM. So capturing that is critical, and I always caution the nurses to not not practice outside their scope. If they don't have the information in the transfer record, they really need to obtain it to get to the correct specificity in order to assign the proper codes. And as we've talked about, as Mike said, there are 188 payment items. Many of them are simply resident diagnosis and or characteristics that need to be captured. So being thorough and detailed in that is a challenge. Section GG has always been a challenge, and the question that nurses often have is how do we collaborate with therapy? Therapy does some assessments of the functional status of the patient on admission, but we need to look at the 3 days, which is the window for capturing information and looking up at the usual performance of the patient in those first 3 days and then the last 3 days of the stay. So just collaborating with therapy effectively is important, and selecting the proper functional score that's accurately a true reflection of the patient's performance. We mentioned just the sheer amount of items on the MDS now that will contribute to payment. And what has become or will become more important than ever is the supporting documentation on the MDS to support the coding on the MDS. So as auditors come to look at these payment items, to look, was it an accurately coded item? Was the documentation in place to support that coding? And charting is always a challenge, and we've been doing lots of charting training in our organization and really encouraging the MDS nurses to ensure that whatever they put on the MDS has that reproducible supporting documentation to support that coding so that it's solid when those auditors come. I mentioned the Medicare A skilled criteria is not changing. And I think as we have in many ways relaxed our oversight in terms of letting therapy be the qualifier in most cases, I think there's an opportunity here to be more to have more holistic view. And as Mike said, we're looking at the care plan for the whole patient and what we're doing for the whole patient and the nursing items and the nursing qualifiers, just managing that and being sure that on a daily skilled basis, the professional services of the nurses and the professional services of the therapy in collaboration with each other are working effectively. And that challenge of collaboration and really being aware of what are our goals for the patient for recovery and are they making progress towards goals and tracking that. And that really just is the clinical management or case management skills that need to be raised to a higher level if they haven't already been for those nurses caring for those patients. And working with therapists as they look at how to put in regimens that are very patient-driven rather than just pushing for the higher therapy minutes as Mike referenced earlier, the fact that all of the care should be individualized. And so our collaboration to become much more astute at how that is happening for the patient is going to be something that I look forward to working with the nurses to really dig into. And we've been doing some training on that with our organization. So those are some of the key challenges that I see of the learning and the opportunity for nurses and therapists to use their skills effectively in this new system.
Thank you, Judy. Mike, do you have any final thoughts on that before we wrap up?
No, I think that what we've been training on is a platform called Long-Term Care Team Steps that was developed by the Agency for Healthcare Quality Research and Quality. It's a specific approach to redesigning tool and team interactions in healthcare facilities, specifically with this version, long-term care healthcare facilities. And I think that that approach is particularly important because the communication methods and requirements are so different, as Judy was discussing. And I think Section GG is a great example because the functional items that are used for assigning someone to a case mix group for occupational therapy and physical therapy, as well as for nursing, overlap in certain items. So having nurses and therapists being able to have a structured approach to arrive at consensus around those functional items is critical, because it affects both, it affects really three components. And it's something that CMS obviously will be using as a checkpoint for assessing how skilled nursing facilities are adhering to their internal policies for patient case group assignment.
Great. We'll be digging into all those issues further in the next episode, where we'll be focusing on these day-to-day operational challenges. But this concludes our first episode. I want to thank again Mike and Judy for participating, and I hope people will tune in for episode 2. Thank you.